Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Tuesday, April 7, 2020. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio in New York, and Taylor Schwenk is producing from his home studio in Connecticut. We open the show today with some sad news. Hall of Famer Al Kaline passed away on Monday at the age of 85. The Hall of Famer played all 22 years of his career in Detroit, earning the nickname Mr. Tiger, an all-star in 15 of his seasons and a 10-time Gold Glove winner in right field. Kaline retired shortly after recording his hit number 3,000 in 1974, and he joined the Tigers broadcasting team. He continued to work for the Tigers after his retirement from the booth in 2002. I got to know Al. What a nice person. We're going to hear more about him, and we'll talk about him more later in the show. According to ESPN's Jeff Passan, Major League Baseball and its players are increasingly focused on a plan that could allow them to start the season as early as May and has the support of high-ranking federal public health officials who believe the league can safely operate amid the coronavirus pandemic. Again, this is sources telling Jeff Passan. The plan would dictate all 30 teams play at stadiums with no fans in the greater Phoenix area, including the Diamondbacks' Chase Field, 10 spring training facilities, and perhaps other nearby fields. Players, coaching staffs, and other essential personnel would be sequestered at local hotels where they could live in relative isolation and travel only to the stadium and back, sources said. The May return date depends on a number of concerns being allayed, and some officials believe a June opening day could be a more realistic possibility. Now, some other thoughts and questions about this from me. I've heard that the team groups will be no more than about 50 people. Based on what I've heard, there will be players wary of this plan out of concern about being away from their families for, as Jeff reported, up to 4.5 months and out of concern for their own health. Major League Baseball and the Players Association need to prepare for the possibility that some players will decline to participate in this plan if it goes off as soon as what was being reported. There is so much that might happen in the world and in the fight against the coronavirus between now and May. It's important to talk about contingencies, but it's also important for baseball not to get caught up in a rush to get back in the face of medical realities. Now, later today, ESPN will air its original broadcast of Cal Ripken's record-breaking game on September 6, 1995, when he passed Lou Gehrig for most consecutive games played. It was one of the most amazing events I've ever covered. I was part of the Baltimore Suns team that year. And today we'll be talking with one of his former teammates, Ben McDonald, about behind the scenes things that happened with Cal. We'll also be talking about Cal's legacy with Sarah Langs. Before we get to Ben and Sarah, check out today's edition of ESPN Daily. Jeff Passan joins Mina Kimes to discuss Major League Baseball's plan to resume in May. Passan also interviews former major leaguer Dan Straley on what it's like to play baseball in South Korea and what lessons can be learned from South Korea, where strict measures have kept baseball sort of on track. That's ESPN Daily with Mina Kimes. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcast, and you can find today's episode in the Baseball Tonight feed. Ben McDonald pitched 9 years in the big leagues. He's a former number one overall pick out of Louisiana State. He pitched with the Orioles, and he was pitching for them when I was a beat writer for the Baltimore Sun. And Ben, I've been tipped off by our producer, Taylor Schwenk, that I have to ask you for your best Go Tigers as we start this broadcast.
Well, Ed Orgeron is taking it to a whole different level, as you know, but he's got that deep growl, and I love when he says, "Go Tigers," you know. I mean, he, there for a while, you know, and look, I'm from down here in Louisiana, and my wife is as Cajun as they come, but I still have trouble understanding Coach Orgeron when he's on TV talking. You know, I get the Go Tigers at the end. I can understand that part of it, but past that, man, it's a struggle sometimes to figure him out. But as long as he keeps winning ball games and winning national titles, I don't care what he sounds like.
Ben, of course, has long worked for the SEC Network, and you were a longtime teammate of Cal Ripken, specifically in 1995, the year that he broke Lou Gehrig's consecutive game record. Gehrig's record had been 21-30, and on September 6, 1995, Cal broke that record. And I'm curious, because it's been interesting, sort of the narrative of time, Ben, that a common refrain you hear is that the home run chase of Sammy Sosa and Mark McGwire brought baseball back. And maybe I was too close to it, but I'll always believe that it was Cal who provided that first important step after the player strike, because the sport really needed to reestablish credibility with fans, and nobody was more credible in baseball because of what the consecutive game streak meant, what was behind it. Yeah, how do you feel generally about how important that was?
Well, I agree with you, Buster. I mean, I was obviously there close to it too. But, you know, after the work stoppage in 94, we needed something good to happen for baseball because obviously the work stoppage was a horrible thing for everybody involved, including the fans especially, you know. And to see Cal go through what he went through and, you know, I always told people, I said, you know, people can't relate to hitting a baseball 500 feet. They can't relate to a guy getting on the mound and throwing 100 miles an hour. But what they can relate to is a guy that got up every day and he put his shoes on, he put his pants on like everybody else did, and he went and answered the bell like a lot of working Americans do, millions of do every day. And I felt like people could relate to that, to getting up, whether you're a little bit sick, knowing you got to go to work, knowing you got to feed your family, going and answering the bell every time. I felt like the average everyday person could relate to something like that. And that's why I think it was so popular, you know, and Cal doing what he did, you know, and for 7 years I played with Cal and he never really talked about it, Buster. You were there a whole lot. He didn't talk about it. Matter of fact, he shied away from it a lot. You know, he just didn't want, and I get it. You know, it wasn't a big topic around our clubhouse. We knew what was going on as the years and the games and the months ticked by. But I really felt like Junior towards the end of that, and you were there. I really felt like the last month of that, I felt like he started to embrace it in a lot of ways, you know, and started to understand what it meant for baseball, what it meant for the everyday person, and to play every day as long as he did was just an amazing. And look, I'll tell you a quick funny story. Phil Regan, I was hurt at that particular time. I had an elbow issue. Phil Regan, the manager of the Orioles at the time, tried to send me down to AA Bowie or Rochester for a rehab assignment. And I said, during this, right when the streak was going to happen, you know, when he was going to break 21-31, I said, Phil, I said, y'all, you guys can find me. You can kick me off the team. You can do whatever you want to do, but I'm not going down to Rochester, New York and miss 21-31. It just ain't going to happen. Cause as you know, we were way out of the race. No matter what we did, we weren't going to win. And I didn't have the wild card and stuff like that, but Phil wanted to send me to a rehab assignment. So after I told him that, he kind of backed off of it until at least Junior broke the record. And I went and did my rehab assignment.
So I've never heard that story before. When you said that to him, did he kind of realize it? Oh yeah. Or was it a smile or was he kind of, cause he was a one and done manager for you guys. What was his response when you said that?
Well, it was almost like he wasn't thinking about it at the time.
Right.
I think he was more caught up in the fact that, hey, you looks like you're well down. We need to get you down for a couple starts and get you back for the rest of the season kind of deal. But then when I told him that, I was like, Phil, 2 days is not going to make a difference. You know, I'm not missing something that's never, ever, ever going to happen again. Just not going to do it. You know, now if we were in the middle of a pennant race, we were one game out, maybe I would have thought about going, right? But because we were 10 or 15, whatever it was, there was no way that I was going to miss Junior breaking that record.
All right. As Cal's teammate, and I asked this plaintively, I asked this to Bill Ripken when we talked to him recently. Do you believe that Cal had special powers to heal, which was always a theory among some of his teammates that I talked to?
There's no doubt in my mind that he had a different gene than most. You know, obviously Billy was his brother. And we used to always, you know, Billy would get hit by a pitch, you know, and Billy would have a bruise like all of us would, like 99.9% of people. If you got hit with a 90-mile-an-hour fastball in the ribs, you would bruise up the size of a volleyball, you know, the next day or two. It just what happens to everybody. I remember I had a locker right next to Cal in Camden Yards for 3 or 4 years, you know, and I remember him getting hit a couple of times. And when nobody was around, I'd say, pick your shirt up. Let me see. And he'd pick his shirt up and show me his ribs. And Buster, I'm not lying to you. There would not even be a bruise on him. I was thinking, there is something wrong with this guy. I mean, he has certain powers that are his body was just an amazing body, as you know. And lost in all that is the size of Cal. And we've always talked about that over the years. But here's a guy that nearly stood 6'5". And when spring training began, he would be 225. But by the time the season ended, he was at 235, you know, and he played the game in the position of shortstop for that many years. And I know he eventually went over to third base, but still the things he did with that size body at that particular time was just amazing to me. And you're right. I mean, we used to play these stupid games all the time, as you know, we'd stay in the clubhouse hours and have an adult beverage or two. And we'd play tape ball, cup ball, wiffle ball, and, you know, he'd punch me in my left shoulder and we'd see if it would bruise up the next day. And I'd punch him, and of course, in his left shoulder. He never had a bruise one time. So I always thought there was something special about him, no doubt.
Yeah, I remember once Roger Clemens, who seemed to have a thing about Brady Anderson, but I remember him hitting Brady in the middle of the back. And the next day, Brady's black and blue covered his entire back. And you're right on Cal. There's a story when you guys had that massive fight with the Seattle Mariners. I think it was in 1992, or either 92 or 93, but there was some question about whether or not Cal would play. Were you aware of that as that all happened? Because his knee got twisted during that fight.
I do remember that. I remember him and Richie Vancells. I remember Junior actually slept in the clubhouse. Not many people know this, but he actually slept in the clubhouse that night trying to get his knee ready to go. And when I got to the ballpark the next day, the word was that Junior wasn't going to be able to answer the bell, that the streak was over with, you know. And somehow, and we saw him do it a lot. I think that might have been the most serious injury that I knew about. But Junior played hurt a lot, as you know. I mean, he had hamstring issues. He had hip issues. He had wrist issues. I mean, he had a lot of stuff that went on, which anybody would during that time, but always found a way to get through it and answer the bell. And I think mechanically his footwork was so good. He knew his body so well. He could adapt to certain swings at the plate, as we saw him have a ton of different batting stances, but he was able to get through it. But I remember that. Yes, I remember him twisting his knee. I remember there was a problem with it. I remember him icing his knee when I left the ballpark that day after all that had happened. And I knew there was something going on, but nobody really knew how severe it was. Of course, Junior was very close to the vest with a lot of that stuff, as you know. And so we really didn't know the depth of it. At the time, they kept it pretty quiet for obvious reasons. But I knew there was a chance when I got to the ballpark the next day that he would not play.
Now, you mentioned how big he is, and I agree with you. People don't realize how big he was. David Howard, who played, of course, with the Royals, told me that when he slid into second base once trying to break up a double play, he said when he hit Cal, it was like sliding into a fire hydrant. He couldn't believe how hard it was. You mentioned some of the clubhouse games that you guys had. And the thing that amazed me, again, I walked into the beat. I had not been around Cal before. And you figure that, you know, someone who's played every game for 15 years or straight years is going to be careful with his body. And you guys wrestled, and the Butcher clubhouse guy, Cal was always going after him. Cal wrestled everybody, it seemed like.
Yeah, that was the kind of deal. People thought Junior walked around in a bubble, you know, the last 7 or 8 years to try to protect himself. But that was the furthest thing from the truth. On off days in Arlington, we used to go to the water park. We'd go down all the crazy slides.
You're kidding.
Swings. We did all kind of crazy stuff. Junior would put his rock spiders on. I'd put mine on. Brady was there. Chris Hoyles would be there. And on an off day, we would go do things like that that people couldn't even imagine that Junior would be doing stuff, because he could get hurt in a heartbeat. And the wrestling matches that we had probably wasn't very smart. And of course, Junior always had the advantage in those because he was bigger and stronger than everybody else. But plus, nobody wanted to be the idiot that hurt Junior. So we were kind of easy on him while he just pummeled us. Not that we could have stopped him anyway, because as far as strength goes, and you talk about that body, it was a once-in-a-lifetime type of a body that he had, you know. But don't get caught in all that. He might have had some genetic makeup, but he also, as you know, Buster, he worked as hard as anybody in the offseason. He worked as hard as anybody in the weight room. And so there was several reasons why he lasted as long as he did.
All right. And you touched on this. I totally agree with you. I remember going to spring training that year after the strike was settled. There was so much attention on him. I could not believe the number of fans who were waiting outside your complex for autographs every day. It was the focus for fans all year. And at the beginning, he kind of blanched at the attention. John Maroon, who was your media relations person that year, they arranged a thing where he would talk to reporters once at the beginning of every series because he didn't want to have constant questions about it. And I think he began to, as you know, I'm borrowing his phrase, he began to look at it as a celebration of baseball. And I agree with you. It happened, you know, halfway through that year, a month ago in that streak.
Yeah, no, I saw that about Junior. And you talk about staying, you know, I hung around Junior a lot. He took to me for whatever reason when I first got called up, and I was pretty close to him. But I watched him for hours, as you know, stay after at home, sign autographs for 2 hours. On the road, he would stay after and just sign just hundreds and hundreds of autographs per night, you know. And he shied away from it. But I also think it's the way that Cal was raised by his dad. You know, the Ripken way was, the game's not bigger than you. You know, the game of baseball was there long before Cal Ripken, and it'll be there long thereafter, the way I think he always looked at it. He never wanted the attention to be on him. You know, he would shy away. He didn't want to talk about it. I think deep down inside, he knew what was going on, but he never set out to break this record. It's just, he kept saying, this is what I do. You know, this is what I do. And we were all put on this earth to do certain things. Well, Cal Ripken was put on this earth to play baseball, and he was there to play baseball every day, and he just wanted to be a part. And I always told him, even through the tough times when he was struggling at the plate, I was like, if you ever take a day off, don't take a day off when I'm on the mound, because I want you back there at shortstop. Because he meant so much to us. Just turning around and seeing number eight back there at the shortstop position, I knew that I had another coach on the field. I knew I had one of the best shortstops in the game behind me on the field as well, you know. And so I wanted him back there every day. I used to mess with him a lot. Just, don't you dare take a day off when I'm out there. But it was good to see him finally embrace it. And he came up with that phrase of a celebration of baseball. And it was in a lot of different ways, because, again, I think the most important thing about that is people could relate to a guy or a person like we all do that get up and goes to work every day. And I think that's what brought baseball back in 95.
And I want to back you up on the autographs. When you said hundreds of autographs after games, people listening might think, no, you're exaggerating. Ben, it was incredible. I was amazed by what he would do. And you know this, that when you would drive into Camden Yards, players would go into Cal had a special parking place where they allowed him to actually park down inside the stadium. He would stop and he would sign autographs there for a time. And then he would go, he would play a game. And then after the game, after he got some food, he would go out at Camden Yards. He'd have a towel. I remember in my mind's eye seeing him sitting outside the home dugout with a towel over one arm, signing everything, balls, pictures, bats, scraps of paper, tickets. And the line would be extended around Camden Yards. I'm guessing he did that three or four times. He did it on the road. At the All-Star game that year, Ben, it was 100. I think it was 108 degrees. It was in Arlington. And so when players got done batting practice, and understandably, they're running down into the tunnel because they're trying to stay cool. Cal stayed out during both batting, National League, American League batting practice, and signed for 2 hours. It was remarkable how much signing he did that year.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, I always tell people this, as far as superstars go, and Cal was obviously a superstar in our game at that time and still is today, but as far as superstars go, he was the most genuine, understanding, level-headed superstar I ever had hung around in my life, you know, and to see him go, and what always amazed me about Junior was the energy level that he had. He had so much energy. I don't know where he got it from, but it seemed like the guy just never really got tired. At times you would see him drained a little bit, but I think he got drained more mentally than he did anything trying to finally get to the finish line in this thing, you know. And but physically, wow, was he in shape. And his mind, you know, his mind was so strong. He was able to overcome a lot of different things from a mental standpoint. But I never really saw him tired. It just seemed like he had the energy level of a 21-year-old all the time. It was just amazing to sit back and take it in. And when you're going through it, it's like a whirlwind. It's kind of like when you get married, you know, you don't really remember the wedding a whole lot, and the reception is like a blur. 21-31 was kind of like a blur for me. I was trying to take it all in, but it all happened so fast. But the more you sit back and you look at it and you realize what he went through from a mental standpoint and a physical standpoint, it's just an amazing streak. And to me, it's one of the most amazing records, that, if not the most amazing record in baseball history.
Oh, and no one will ever touch it for 1,000 different reasons. No one will get close. The final number for Cal when the streak stopped was 2,632 consecutive games. Now, you made reference to he tied the record on September 5th, 1995. The next night, he breaks the record, 2,131 at Camden Yards. They would unfurl the numbers on the warehouse. And I got to tell you, as a baseball fan, that was such an emotional time, and it wasn't only the fans were emotional, it were the players on the other teams. What do you remember about that night? Of course, Cal naturally hit home runs in both games, in 21-30 and 21-31.
Yeah, Cal always had a flair for the dramatic, no doubt about that, is he hit homers in both games you mentioned. I remember his last All-Star game, too. He hit the home run, too. Just an amazing thing. But I remember the atmosphere at Camden Yards during those two ball games. When you talk about 21-30, 21-31, I never got to play in the playoffs, unfortunately, in my career, never experienced that World Series. But I can't imagine the atmosphere being more than what it was those two nights, especially on 21-31. It was just an amazing. You could almost just cut it with a knife out there. It was just a really cool time. And I was on the injured list at the time, so I brought my old 8-track video camera with me. Of course, I had the locker next to Cal that I mentioned. So I actually videoed him getting dressed. I videoed him in the training room getting his ankles taped that night. I even had the camera running when he hit the home run from the dugout.
Wow.
21-31 too. So I have all that. I need to go find it. I found it about 10 years ago and I put it away, but it's on a little old 8-track tape. And so I videoed all those things just so I could go back one day and show my kids and my kids' kids, you know, what this moment meant. I think we all knew in some ways what it meant, and it was a record that would never be touched again. But just to be there and be a part of it, you're right. It was so emotional. I mean, I remember being in tears when they finally dropped the banner down off the warehouse of 2131, just an amazing number in itself, you know, and I was so happy and for him and his family and everybody else.
You need to get that digitized, Ben. I mean, go and get that stuff and get it off the old VHS tape or whatever, the 8-track. And get
it. I do. I need to put that on disc because that's obviously history, and I need to go. I'm glad we're having this conversation because I'm going to go find that tape and get it run off and get it to where hopefully we can preserve it for a long time because there's probably not too many of those out there.
So when that number unfurls, 2131, you know, their cheers and Cal a couple times, you know, gives the wave, and then tries to go back in the dugout, and players are pushing it back out, Oriole players. And eventually, if I remember correctly, Rafael Palmeiro, Bobby Bonilla kind of shove him out there to take a lap around the field. That pause in the game lasted more than 20 minutes. And, you know, you look at the Angels players, they loved it. Like, it wasn't like they were. If you remember, there's a scene when Pete Rose broke Ty Cobb's record. Eric Schau is a pitcher from the Padres. He was kind of grumpy about the delay in the game, and he sat on the mound angry about it. In this case, the Angel players came out in front of their dugout to high-five him.
Yeah, I think everybody, and the Angels included, and tip of the cap to them, they understood the importance and the history that was going on during this. You know, and Junior – I mean, typical Junior, right? He didn't want to take that lap. He didn't want to make it more than what it was. You know, he was ready to get in the dugout and get the game moving. That's how he played the game, and that's how he was raised to play the game. But at the end of the day, I remember Rafi and Bobby pushing him out there and he ended up taking that lap. Like you said, it took well over 20 minutes to finally finish it up. But just a historic moment. And one of the highlights of my career, just being there and being, although I wasn't really a part of it, just being a small, small part of it to witness it, is something that sticks out as one of the number one things in my entire career.
Did you get him on video after the game, or did you have a moment to say something to him after that night?
Well, I had the locker next to him, you know, and I remember shaking his hand before the game, you know, and of course after the game, just for a brief second, because he was so busy, as you know, I mean, just ripping and running when it was all over. But I had a chance to give him a hug and tell him congratulations and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, Junior just gave you that old smile with them blue eyes, you know. And so you could tell it was a relief off of him. I remember him. I felt like he lost a little bit of weight there toward the end. But from a mental standpoint, it was just wearing on him, and he wanted to get it over with so bad, you know. And so I know it was like a weight lifted off his shoulders when 21-31 finally passed.
So, Ben, I've got a story that I'll never forget, to me, that embodied Cal in terms of what his preparation was and how it seriously took baseball. But it happened long after he broke that record. So the record goes down, and if you remember, he went into a deep slump. And it's not surprising because it was so emotional and so much energy. I'm sure he was exhausted to some degree. I think it was like 3 for 40. And in one of the last days of the season, you guys were in Detroit, and he has an offer. And it's an afternoon game, and I you know, go into the clubhouse, and I get my quotes from players, and I'm up in the press box at Tiger Stadium. And I'm writing my story, and I look down on the field, and I'm like, who the heck is walking out in the field an hour after the game? Well, it was Cal going out there with a tee to put on home plate with a bucket of balls, and he's going to hit the ball. He's going to put the ball on the tee and empty a bucket of balls because he's trying to find his swing. Now, this guy at that time is the most powerful man in baseball. He's a national hero. He just established his record. The games, as you referenced down the stretch that year, were basically meaningless in terms of wins and losses. And yet in the last days of the season, he's focused on trying to find his swing. He empties the bucket of balls. And at some point, Brady Anderson came out, and maybe a coach came out. Elrod Hendricks, a longtime coach for the Orioles, came out, and they helped him pick up the balls. And then he did it again. And that, to me, that story in an empty Tiger Stadium said so much about Cal.
Look, Junior was a perfectionist, you know that, and he wanted, and he felt like the only way was work. Work got me to where I am. Having an attitude of I'm going to outwork the next guy got him to where he is, you know, because when you talk about talent, Junior was extremely talented, but he busted his butt every day to be the best that he could. And I remember I was part of that sometimes too, you know, late nights in the Kingdome, he would want to go hit a bucket of balls. He'd say, hey, you pitching the next day? I go, no, I'm pitching in 3 days. He goes, get out here and shag some balls for me. Yes, sir. You know, I'll go out there and shag some balls for me. He'd hit a bucket of balls, you know, at 11 o'clock, 11:30 at night in the King Dome, and I'd go out there and pick him up and bring him to him, and he'd hit another bucket of balls, you know. But he wanted, and he was always searching to try to be the best, and he wanted to try to figure out what was going on. He felt like the only way he could figure it out was to go out there and work it out himself. He knew his body so well. He knew what he was doing. He just had to get back in the groove and do those kind of things. But that's the kind of guy he was, and I think that's what led to the streak of wanting to be the best. I think he was like a lot of us, is that he was scared to fail. He did not want to fail, and he was going to do anything he could to help the team. It was always about the team and what could I do to get better every day.
Now, you mentioned that it's like Cal, in some respects, had magical powers. You know, there were the import of his streak and whether or not he should continue the streak was a constant conversation among media members like myself. And my old colleague, my old teammate, Ken Rosenthal, wrote a column in the Baltimore Sun one day saying, okay, it's time to end the streak. And in his first plate appearance that day, Cal hits a foul ball, low line drive, back into the press box, and it hit Kenny's laptop and destroyed it, which was for us in the press box was absolute confirmation of Cal being touched by baseball gods. Yes?
Yes, no doubt about that. You know, his point was always that what good is it going to do to me to take one day off? You know, now, if I took 2 weeks off, maybe that would help, right? Maybe that would help get my body going again a little bit. Maybe he was physically a little bit tired, although I never felt like he really showed that, you know. But his point was, I had a conversation with him one night, was, you know, everybody's talking about me taking a day off, but really, and I agree with him. I said, what good is you taking one day off going to do, you know? And that was always his point. And of course, as you know, his other point was, you know what, I may be struggling at the plate, but I can help on defense. I can help win games in a lot of different ways. And Junior certainly did that with his glove, you know. And as you know, Buster, he was a huge part of my maturing process. He called all the 1992 pitches I ever threw in 35 starts. He called every pitch from shortstop with me and Chris Hoyles to help me kind of figure out things that were going on and learning the league and learning how to pitch a little bit. Then we'd sit down after each game with a six-pack of beer, and we would talk about, okay, this is why I wanted to throw this guy this pitch in this situation. This is why we did this here. And that really helped speed up my learning curve at the big league level because, as you know, I didn't get a whole lot of minor league experience. Then I went straight to the big leagues almost. And so I had to kind of learn on the fly, and Junior was a huge part of me starting to try to figure things out along the way.
Now, last one for you. Your old teammate, Mike Flanagan, once told me when we were debating about the streak and you know, whether it should be ended and what was the value of it. And Flanny had a great point. He said, you know, here's the thing is that Cal, you know, he absolutely is embedded in the idea of doing what he can on a daily basis to help his team win. And Flanny thought that if you just arbitrarily took away the consecutive game streak, then in a sense it would be, and these are his words, you know, you're taking the cape away from Superman. You're taking the utility belt away from Batman, that in some sense that it had meaning to Cal because it for him, it was almost like self-affirmation. Do you agree with that, buy that?
Oh, absolutely. I agree with that, you know, because when you think about Cal Ripken, you don't think about over 3,000 hits and the longevity that he had. What comes to mind is the Iron Man, right? What comes to mind when you first think about, hey, he's the guy that broke Lou Gehrig's record. He's the guy that played in 2,600 plus consecutive games. That's what always pops in my mind first, although he was as good a shortstop as there was with the glove and the accuracy of the arm and everything. But that's I always relate Junior to, is a guy that got up and answered the bell every day and went to work every day, no matter what was going on in his life, no matter what was going on with his body. He came to work every day. And I agree with that, with what Flanagan said. I mean, if you take that away from him at that particular time, I don't think it changes the way he plays or anything, but maybe it puts a little dent in the shield a little bit in some ways.
All right, Ben. Well, it's been great talking with you. Thanks for the memories. And as I told you before we got going, it's been fun watching you on television because I can say, yeah, I covered that guy.
Yeah, it's been a long time ago, but I appreciate that, Buster. Good talking to you, and y'all stay safe.
Numbers game.
Sarah Langs, a reporter and a producer for MLB.com. And Sarah, before we get to Cal Ripken and what his record means in baseball history, you're the daughter of a rock star. Your mom was on CNN yesterday?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm so proud of her. So she is the chief of infectious diseases at Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx in New York. And she has been one of a handful of doctors and scientists working on this concept of convalescent plasma, which is essentially the idea of taking the blood of people who have already recovered from COVID-19 and giving it to people either to protect them from getting it or even to help people recover. And CNN was interested in talking about that. They had her on. It said New York doctor spearheading effort. I was so proud of her. She did a great job. And, you know, it's kind of fun because I've done some TV and now she has too. And it was really fun to give her some tips and, you know, see how awesome she did.
Yeah. What was the advice you gave her?
I helped her set up her shot. You know, we got to do this from home. We set it up. We do everything like that. And I told her not to be nervous. I told her just to, you know, be, it's kind of similar with, you know, when I go talk stats on TV, right? She's super informed about what she's saying. So as long as you trust that, you're going to do great. So.
And you gave her, I'm guessing you gave her a hug when it was over.
I wish I could have, but we're not nearby and we're following rules, but I gave her a lot of virtual hugs.
Oh, okay. See, I thought when you said you set up her shot, like you literally were the,
oh,
like
no.
the tech at her house. Okay.
Over FaceTime. You know, we got to do what we got to do.
Exactly. All right. So we just heard from Ben McDonald's tremendous stories about Cal Ripken, and especially around the year that he broke the record, 1995, when he passed Lou Gehrig's record of 2,130 consecutive games. Of course, he went on, and the final record before he finally stopped the streak in September of 1998, 2,632 consecutive games. No one will ever come close again. Help me put that number into context.
Yes. So Buster, you asked me this great question, which I was so excited to dig into, which was how many of the current active streaks would we have to add up through the end of the 2019 season to get to or close to the 2,632? So the folks at the Elias Sports Bureau helped me out with this one. And we would need to add up the top 61 consecutive games played streaks that are active at the end of the 2019 season, we would get 2,636, so just four more. And the longest active streak is Whit Merrifield at 247. So just thinking about Cal Ripken did that all by himself, and we would need 61 players active streaks. And obviously, that's not how math works, but just adding those all up, that's what we would have to do get in that range.
Wow. Can you tweet that out and I'll retweet it. That's for sure. That would be a cool number. As I say, no one will ever touch that record for 1,000 different reasons. One, with the way the teams rest players. Two, with the time that Cal broke the record, there was a lot of sort of under the surface conversation about, boy, do we want a player in that position and, you know, to have that sort of effective power over his situation. So that'll never happen again. But what, in your eyes, are some of baseball's unbreakable records besides that one?
Yeah. So one thing I do want to say about that one, and then we'll get into some others, is that just to your point that this will absolutely never happen again. The longest streak by any player since Cal Ripken's streak was Miguel Tejada with 1,152 games, and that was 2000 to 2007. I mean, these days, when you look at what the longest active games played streak is, it's close to what I said with Whit Merrifield. You know, it's somewhere between 200 and 300 games. A couple years ago, I think that Manny Machado was actually the active leader when it was one of the anniversaries of Cal Ripken's streak. I don't remember exactly which year it was, but it was when he was still on the Orioles. So it was a fun little, you know, full circle thing, but it was like 200 something games. So we do not expect to see these even getting into the 500s lately. So that is certainly, I think, a number one in baseball. Some other ones. I think Ricky Henderson, I think, with stolen bases, whether you go with his 132 in 1982 or his 1,406 in his career, last player to attempt 130 steals in a season for his single season record was Vince Coleman in 1985. That is a long time ago. That is not going to happen again. And the active steals leader through the 2019 season was Rajai Davis, who's 38 years old. And probably only arguably active because he wasn't on a major league roster at that time. And he had 415. So just about 1,000 shy of Ricky. I don't think that one is going to be happening anytime soon, especially with how we see how the game is being played. I mean, stolen bases are way, way down. Another one that we have to mention, Barry Bonds, 232 walks in 2004. So the only player other than Bonds with 170 or more walks in a season is Babe Ruth in 1923. So this is not a thing that has been happening lately. and he got 120 intentional walks in that 2004 season. The only player other than Bonds to get more than 45 intentional walks in a season was Willie McCovey in 1969. So again, when the other player to do it hasn't done it since, it just doesn't feel like these records are going to fall in any way. And I mean, we saw the Astros not issue an intentional walk last year. We've seen things change with the intentional walk because the rule has changed, and it just doesn't feel like that's something that's going to be padding anyone's walk totals anytime soon. And if I were to add another one, if we want three aside from Cal Ripken's, I think I would go with Hack Wilson, 191 RBI in 1930. Yeah. I mean, Manny Ramirez had 165 in 1999. And that's the closest since. And there's been a lot of time to have a closest since. We're talking about 1930 this was set. I mean, and Manny would have needed at least another month to get close, right? I just don't see that happening, especially for the same reason that Cal Ripken isn't happening. I just think that the way guys are rested and the quantity of games they play and how aware we are of maybe certain medical things and, okay, we should give him a day off here. Those kinds of things seem to, you know, all of these are about accumulation. And I just don't see them happening.
No, I agree with you. And you know, and I know back in 1930, when you had a player that good generating that many RBIs, if that sort of thing happened these days, they would just pitch around them. Like Mike Trout doesn't drive in 140 runs a year for a reason. It's not because he's not good. He's just not going to get the opportunity, just like Barry Bonds did. By the way, Sarah, you'll be excited to hear as we continue Manager's Week starting on Wednesday. We are going to hear from your friend Bruce Bochy some good Barry Bonds stories.
Well, that's very exciting.
Yep, absolutely. Thanks for doing this, Sarah, and congrats on your mom.
Thanks so much for having me, and thank you, Buster.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Tuesday. Got a couple tweets about Al Kaline here. Jeremy T at Jeremy Tiermini writes in, like many kids, I had tough times with my father. One thing that cut the tension was baseball cards and listening to him talk about his favorite player, Al Kaline. No question for you guys. Just wanted to say rest in peace, Mr. Kaline. Thanks for the memories.
Yeah, he was such a nice person. He's a great player, first off. And you heard Jim Cott last week on the podcast and the storytelling we did with Jim talk about how great Kaline was. You know, he had 10 homers off Jim, and he talked about all the great things that Kaline did on the field. I mean, you could not have been a nicer person than Al was off the field. And you saw that in a lot of the tweets that came out from players yesterday, including that from Justin Verlander. Brad Ausmus, who managed the Tigers, reached out to me last night because he wanted to send out some thoughts on social media. You know, he talked in the text messages we were exchanging last night about what a great guy Al was. His text was, Al was one of the kindest, most knowledgeable and humble baseball people I ever met. Going back to my days as a Tiger player, he was not only approachable, but went out of his way to talk to you. I always trusted Al. And we'll never forget the innumerable, honest, insightful conversations we had. I am honored to have called him a friend and will miss him greatly. Rest in peace, Mr. Tiger. Yeah, Taylor, a few years ago at the winter meetings, I happened to be on the same plane as Al, and we were waiting at baggage, and he walked over to me and he was like, hey, Buster, you're going over to the winter meetings, right? I've got a car waiting. Would you like a ride?
Oh, nice.
I haven't had many other Hall of Famers do that. Right?
That's awesome.
I mean, he was a phenomenal player, but again, when you talk to people about him, the first thing everyone talks about is what a nice person he was.
Our guy Mitchell at Tigers_of_DET writes in, who is the closest thing to a modern day Al Kaline?
Ronald Acuna Jr., if you're talking about what they accomplished right at the outset of their careers. You know, Al Kaline's first year in the big leagues is one of the best ever. And when those lists come up, you know, with Mike Trout and Ronald Acuna Jr., Juan Soto for best production at the outset of his career, Al Kaline is on those lists.
Just interesting kind of stat-ish nugget that Bias Cat at Bias_Cat writes in. Inspired by Hembo's stat about Jim Cott's opponents, batter with the earliest birthday, Ted Williams, August 30th, 1918, and the latest birthday was Jose Oquendo, July 4th, 1963. 45 years apart, Oquendo was born 4 years after Cott's debut.
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable. Jose Oquendo, of course, longtime infielder and coach, third base coach and first base coach for the St. Louis Cardinals.
And last one here for today, similar to a question we had yesterday and kind of relevant overall to our discussion about baseball returning really in any fashion. Jackie Lee writes in, Taiwan's Chinese Professional Baseball League is set to be the first professional baseball league in the world to start its season this year on April 11th. Will Buster tune in to watch the opening game of the league, assuming you can find it?
Yeah, and assuming that they actually start on time.
Yeah,
because there's some questions about that, you know, whether or not some of these target dates are going to be pushed back. I'll watch baseball of any kind at this point. I'm looking forward to that Cal game. Yeah. I have not watched that game from beginning to end since I was there in person back in 1995, Taylor.
I've seen, you know, pretty big chunks of it, but I think I'm going to watch the whole thing front to back tonight. I'll throw it on the DVR, and, you know, maybe after I'm done binging Sex in the City, I'll turn that one on when the wife goes to bed.
There you go.
All right. Subscribe, rate, and review to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter.
That's it for today. My thanks to Ben McDonald, to Sarah Langs, and Taylor Schwenk. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And before we go, I want you to hear last from Al Kaline. Here's part of his Hall of Fame speech in 1980.
When I was a youngster, life was a baseball game. There was nothing more exciting than a good old game of ball. I played a lot of ball games growing up in Baltimore, every day from spring to fall. I never would have had that chance to prepare for a career every boy dreams of without the love and hard work of two people, my mom and dad.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.